We'll call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. The time is 1:35 PM on today, April 30th, 2024. Today, I'm joined by Co-Chair Hoffman, Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, and myself, Senator Olson. We're hearing two bills today, or hearing two presentations on the rail belt transmission grid. First is by Curtis Thayer, the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. Second is by Gwen Holdman from the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So everybody knows the committee's in possession of this bill. DEC will introduce 217 tomorrow afternoon under bills previously heard. We also have other personnel within the gallery who maybe come on up to go ahead and give their opinion and commentary on the bill that we're hearing. Mr. Thayer, please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
All right, thank you. My name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. Today's presentation is modernizing the rail belt electric grid, and when this presentation was developed, SB 217 was a different bill. So we'll spend probably more time on the rail belt than what the bill was. A little bit about AEA. AEA is the our mission is to lower the cost of energy in Alaska, and we do that by diversifying Alaska's electric energy profile, increasing resilience, reliability, and redundancy. We're broken up into six different sections or project areas. One is rail belt energy, what we refer to as owned assets. That's Bradley Lake, that's the intertie, the SSQ line, hard assets that we have and own and operate. Another one is power cost equalization, which is very important to rural Alaska. As you know, it's a $1 billion endowment that is managed by the Alaska Permanent Fund. And in the earnings of those funds, we work within the RCA, with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, and we administer those funds into rural Alaska. And basically what it does is we look at the RCA tells us what the weighted cost of energy between Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau is. It's about 20 cents. And so we subsidize, or the program subsidizes rural Alaska up to about 75 cents. So as that floor moves up or down, that affects the PCE, but the cap remains the same. And it's about $45 million that goes into rural Alaska, and it affects 82,000 Alaskans. Rural energy, another area that we do is we construct bulk fuel tank farms, diesel powerhouses, and with electrical distribution grids in rural Alaska, there's about 197 communities. That's an ongoing project. When you hear of electrical emergencies, we are, for about 40 communities, their 911 call. There are other, like AVAC and others, that work with certain communities. But the smaller they get, the more they're dependent on AEA. We also do renewable energy efficiency. That is done funding through technical assistance, analysis, energy technologies. This also includes biomass, hydro, solar, wind, electric vehicles. And then we have two grants and loans. Our grant that we're most known for is the Renewable Energy Fund. The legislature has funded that fund to the tune of a little over $330 million. And it has displaced, as of this fall when we did an analysis, 85 million gallons of diesel fuel. So it definitely has a huge effect on it. 80% of those funds are primarily in rural Alaska. There's over 100 active projects that have been spurned from the Renewable Energy Fund. So just looking in certain communities, you look at Prince of Wales Island, Halungni, that was started as a REF program. When you look at wind and you look at Shovel Creek up at Fairbanks, that started as a REF program. You look at gasification from our garbage dumps in the Kenai Peninsula, that had started as a REF program. Same thing with a lot of hydro and solar and wind projects across the state. And so really, just recently, the Department of Energy awarded $125 million to rural Alaska for energy projects, and the majority of those started as a REF program. And the state had invested $12 million for the feasibility and reconnaissance stage, and now they're grown into full-fledged projects. And then our loan program is our Power Project Fund, where we do fund projects with patient capital. We funded the two largest solar projects in Alaska, up in Willow, and also in Houston. In addition to Halungni, also has $20 million on that as far as we've loaned them. We have, and one thing I will say, we have no default. So we've had very success, a lot of success with that program. The most recent grant we did was for the Whistle Stop down in the Kenai Peninsula for a small solar array for them. And then energy planning, collaboration with local and regional partners, AEA provided economic and engineering analysis for planned development of cost-effective energy infrastructure. One of our biggest projects that we did was assisting with the Governor's Energy Task Force last year that came up, that met for 150 hours. And we came up with 60 recommendations. A lot of those you see in legislation that's pending before the legislature today. Just a quick snapshot of active projects and services in Alaska. This could be anywhere from PCE to where our circuit riders, where we have circuit riders that are going to rural Alaska. Also owned assets. This is also looking at a lot of the renewable opportunity that we have. And so our footprint across the state on any given day is in all these various communities. And so it is a daunting task, but this is what we do every day. Our topic for today is that looking at the modernization of the rail belt grid. So when you look at this map, it's a little busy here, but it's talk about rail belt opportunities. And if you look at the very bottom, it says Dixon Diversion, $342 million, AEA owned. Where that is Dick Bradley Lake. Bradley Lake is a state asset. It's been owned by AEA at 32 years. It's been in operation, and it provides the lowest cost energy on the rail belt at about 4 cents a kilowatt. It was actually, as some have noted recently, but it passed the legislature by one vote 32 years ago, and now it's providing the lowest cost energy on the rail belt. So it's been a kind of the crown jewel. And with that, it provides 10% of the power on the rail belt. And one of the opportunities that we're looking at is what we call the Dixon Diversion, where there's a similar glacier, lake, river on the Bradley footprint. And we're looking at diverting that water 5 miles into Bradley Lake, which would increase Bradley Lake by 50%. But to really put it in terms that we all need to know of today is it would displace 1.5 billion cubic feet of natural gas, or 7.5% of the unmet needs in 2030. So it's a huge project. There's a couple of different things for funding opportunities I'll bring up on that. Traditionally, when we're running the economics of it, we have been looking at the revenue bonds to pay for it, but we've also applied for an EPA grant in the full amount of $342 million. It does not require a state match. We will know that probably in the August-September time period. And then also there are tax credits available, possibly up to 50%. And so we're running a couple different scenarios. Obviously, having it paid for completely is the best benefit to the ratepayer, but we're running all the different scenarios. And then as you move up the up north, you have the Homer system, but then you'll see where it says best potential AEA ownership. And that is they have a battery in they have a battery energy storage system in Sedona that helps with the oscillation issues that we sometimes have at low water with Bradley. It was a design issue 32 years ago, and so that oscillation. So we've been working with the BPMC, the Bradley Lake Management Committee, and looking to see if there's an opportunity there to purchase part of that battery. And as you move further north, there's also a battery opportunity. Chugach Electric and Manitowoc Electric Association are building a battery right now, a BESS system to help them with the transition. And with that, we are looking to see if it's cost effective for AEA to be involved in the ownership of that battery. And again, there's tax credits that up to 50% to help pay for that battery. And then as you move further north to Fairbanks, that's the same case, is looking at a BESS system in Fairbanks to help with their needs. As far as, again, with renewables, you know, there's a transition off and on you need with a battery. And then also in case there's any power outages or such and you can time your batteries. The battery, like, for example, in Kenai is good for 2 hours for 42 megawatts. And so if there's a problem on the system, that helps levelize that. And again, if there's that oscillation or other issues, the Kenai battery. So we're looking at across that. And I jumped ahead a little bit, but where you have the best, where it says potential ownership up near Sedona, right above that, you see the Sterling Quartz line, $90 million AEA owned. There's a 39-mile transmission line that goes from Sterling over to Quartz Creek. If you drive on the Kenai Peninsula and you're over by Hope, you'll see a big substation as you go up the hill. Right behind that second ridge is kind of where our line ends, and that happens to be Chugach, but it's kind of at that dividing point. There's a $90 million upgrade. This is the line that AEA purchased from Homer Electric 4 years ago. There was a fire. That line was out of commission for four months. That line, the reason we purchased it, was it did not serve Homer consumers, but it did serve the northern utilities. And so there was a tie-in to Bradley Power getting it north. And with that, we did bond with the utilities $166 million, of which $90 million has been committed to do this upgrade. This upgrade has actually been in the works the last 2 years. Matter of fact, we're taking equipment this summer, and the conduit is supposed to be delivered this summer, and the tower is over the winter and into the spring. So this is a project that will be ongoing. It will probably take at least 4 years to do. The reason being is you cannot island Bradley for more than about 60 days. So you have to mobilize, demobilize, and you have a 60-day window because the one thing we do not want to do is ever spill Bradley water. So that's one of our constraints. The big topic of the conversation this legislative session was, you look off to the left, is the HVDC line known as GRIP 3, round one, for $413 million. That was an award that AEA applied with utilities successfully for. To put that in context, is there were over 700 GRIP applications, 58 were selected, and AEA received the fifth highest award, and it was a competitive grant. So there's a lot of time and effort spent on that. We were very successful in that. And that does, the federal government will match 206, and so there needs to be a $206 million match. And the governor in his budget, we have $20 million out of the 166 bonding and about 13.7, which is $33.7 million, which is more than enough money for the first year because the feds will match that. So that's really $66 million. And our first bit of work on that is primarily going to be a lot of engineering, procurement, and obviously routing studies across Cook Inlet. And then if we go north, we have the HVDC line, GRIP 3, round 2, $730 million, AEA owned. This has been recently applied to, as in last week, which is a similar program, and this will continue the HVDC line from Beluga all the way up to Healy. But with this would be an overhead line, and it's about 250 miles. So it's a much larger line, but we're not also transversing the Cook Inlet. So there's definitely an advantage there. And then off to the right is the kind of the purple hash line, and that's the proposed road belt. That's been discussed for many years, 20-plus years, at least in the legislature. And that is taking a line from Sutton over to Glenel and then up to Delta Junction and into Fairbanks and also into Tok. The Fairbanks line is green. It goes to Delta Junction. You see a hashtag to Black Rapids training site. That is actually a grant that AEA worked with Golden Valley, and that's worth $15.7 million. And that's to extend that transmission line to a military training so they're not using diesel fuel. They're actually part of the grid.
Are you done with that slide?
I'm done with that.
Anyway, when you get done with the slide, you're going to change it. We'll stop and have any questions by members of the committee. Do you have any questions by members of the committee on this slide or previous slides that he has? One of the questions I do have, you talked about some of the projects that were happening throughout the state, rural Alaska, the solar panels in particular that were just put up there in Willow. Who owns those solar panels? Does the city own them? Does the utility own them? Or who owns it?
Mr. Chair, in what regard? What solar panels?
I thought you had talked about one of the biggest solar panel projects in the state of Alaska had to do with Willow.
Excuse me. Thank you.
I was wondering who owned the solar panels once you get done with construction.
That's an independent power producer. Mm-hmm. They actually borrowed money from AEA through our power project fund for those two, actually all three of those solar projects. So they were loaned to private individuals, and they are paying it back on commercial terms.
I see. Any other question for Mr. Thayer by members of the committee? One of the other questions I do have is, what does BESS stand for? What kind of battery is that?
Battery Energy Storage System. Uh-huh. That's the BESS. Tesla is the actual brand that Homer Electric Association has, and Tesla is also the same brand that Chugach Electric Madison Electric Association are doing a joint facility off of Minnesota, and that's a Tesla battery system also.
The other question I have is, my understanding, I'm not a transmission person or electric person myself, but it's my understanding that DC power being put over a fair amount of distance loses its power. Is that? But I see a lot of DC lines that are going on up the HVDC power grid that you have going north there. How do you overcome that loss of energy as you go over a distance?
Mr. Chair, the HVDC lines are actually highly efficient lines. One thing that you don't have is you cannot take a lot of, it's kind of a highway, so to speak, where you're not pulling a lot of power off the lines like you do the regular radio lines that you see, where you can pull it off and use substations to bring it down into distribution. So it is kind of like a highway. So the HVDC line would go from basically Kenai, Nikiski, across to Beluga, across the inlet, and then from Beluga to Healy. Now, again, we don't have funding from Beluga to Healy. That's just an application phase. But then that would be connected. So you tap off for Anchorage, and then it would be a nonstop line all the way up to Healy. So it's highly efficient in that regard.
And if you don't have the funding, though, for that line going from Beluga north, do you get a loan for that?
Mr. Chair, that's a conversation we would need to have with the utilities. Before GRIP was a thing, or IIJ was a bill, there was conversations had with utilities and AAA of how to upgrade the lines, because the one thing we need is we need redundancy. We have a single point all the way from Homer to Fairbanks, and therefore, just like when we had the fire on the SSQ line, and it was down for 4 months. So that meant that for 4 months, the northern utilities did not receive Bradley power, and it cost them $12 million in the summertime to buy an additional natural gas to keep the lights on. And so the second line would allow us to move power either direction and give us the redundancy that we need. And it's really key, the fact that we have five military bases, and we're one of the only places in the country where we only serve by one power line into these military facilities. So it's really key to have the two.
Any other questions by members of the committee for Mr. Thayer? If not, go ahead.
I'm sorry. This is just a little bit on Bradley. I might have jumped a little bit as far as Bradley being 120 megawatts, 10% of the rail belt. It does affect, or it does provide power for 550,000 Alaskans or 55,000 homes. And it's about approximately $20 million in savings per year to railroad utilities from Bradley versus the use of natural gas. And, of course, that differential is growing as natural gas costs are higher. When we talk about the Dixon Diversion, you'll see in orange at the top, you'll see Bradley Lake. And then the Dixon Diversion is the Dixon Glacier. And there's a proposed dam site. And then the purple line, or hot fuchsia line, I guess, is a 5-mile directional drill, 14 feet, that would dump into Bradley. You would need to raise the Bradley by 14 feet, and then that would put more water behind the dam, which would therefore increase Bradley by about 50%. And this is something that we believe we can have completed by 2030. One of the utilities asked us to see if we can do it by 2029, and so we're actually kind of running that modeling to see if we can do that, because the sooner we have this online, the more natural gas it displaces in the long term. Wire transmission upgrades needed.
Hey, I already have a question.
Sorry.
It's understood.
Yeah, if we can go back to page 6, please. So, Mr. Thayer, just on, you got 4 cents up there for cost generation. I assume that there's zero debt on this.
Bradley was paid off 2 years ago, so there is no debt on there. The dam was paid off. Bradley was paid off. We have bonded $166 million against Bradley to start transmission upgrades. This was something that we did, I say we, with the utilities and the AEA board. We did that before IIJ, before GRIP, before federal funding, knowing that we had required project work to upgrade transmission lines like the SSQ line. So we were proactive in borrowing funds against the dam in order to do these upgrades.
Bob, so I understand.
Yes, so it's just what you're showing us here is the cost of basically the spin rate of debt-free hydro asset.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes.
And then, Mr. Chairman, I know we're getting into this for the next several days or a couple of weeks here. It would be nice if we could have an updated heating cost or BTU cost comparison between our energy sources, if it's diesel fuel, cost per kilowatt, direct electric or electric and natural gas, so we can see on a BTU equivalency as we jump across. So if in this case, if the spin rate is 4 cents, where are we at on the cost of a comparative to other energy sources? As we eventually get into looking at the cost of energy to Fairbanks and Anchorage and other areas around the state.
Are you able to provide us that information?
Mr. Chair, yes, we have that information.
When can we expect it?
I will have it to you tomorrow morning.
You would please. Does that sit with your timeline, Senator Stipman?
Yes, that would be good. I think that's going to be helpful. I know there's some concerns about the running out of or low on Cook Inlet natural gas, but there's equal concerns in Fairbanks at the cost per kilowatt of that community, and then other concerns out in Western Alaska when they're running off of diesel fuel. And we need some uniform methodology to compare costs to the burner tip as a whole.
Through the chair, we'll provide that tomorrow. And if it is not what you're looking for exactly, we can tweak it accordingly. But we do have something, right on mark.
We'd appreciate it. Another question, Senator Bishop.
Just include coal in that as well, please. I know somebody behind you has got the answer to that. You've seen it in the committee.
I only smile because that's not on there. But.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a statement. I support this. You know, I think we need to reduce energy costs throughout the state of Alaska. But and I don't have problems in looking at and trying to make the lowest energy costs in the state on the rail belt lower. But we need to look at what we're doing as a state to lower energy costs for all Alaskans, because we're all in this together. And that needs to be said, because the amount of energy that people in rural Alaska are paying are sometimes 10 times higher than that of the rail belt, even without this upgrade. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
One of the concerns that I have is we're dealing with pennies per kilowatt hour on this transmission line, which is a priority for the legislature, and understandably so, because we have a lot of people there. But when you look at what people are paying out there, it's well over a dollar a kilowatt hour in some of the communities where supposedly the natural gas comes from, and they're not benefiting from that as well. Mr. Thayer, go ahead and continue.
Right, thank you. I think we've, with transmission upgrades, obviously, why are they needed? For energy security, for our diversification and reliable energy. And as I mentioned earlier, we only have one line going north to south. If we were a FERC regulated, we would require a minimum of at least two lines. And so we're not even up to national standards with what we have for an electrical system.
Senator Stedman has a question.
And as we're speeding along, and I'm still putting the bases under my feet, I guess, to understand this. Give me a little bit of background on Bradley Lake as far as I understand a proposed tunnel and expansion. We've done that in Southeast. It works very well. Is there any impact or upgrades needed to the penstock? Is there any upgrades or modifications needed to the turbines? Is there extra turbine that's not being used there, or what's Or is it at max and you're just going to bank more water?
Mr. Thayer.
Through the chair, thank you for that question. That's the advantage of this particular project is other than doing the directional drill for the 5 miles and raising the dam, we do not have to do anything in addition to the powerhouse. The powerhouse actually has two 60-megawatt generators, and what it will do is actually allow us to run them more efficiently because part of this is we have to do these transmission upgrades. We're constrained at Bradley primarily because we don't have the transmission lines to take the power north out of Bradley. And so as we do an HVDC line or we upgrade the SSQ line on the Kenai Peninsula, that's going to reduce that's the big advantage. And one thing I think it's important to note, 17% of the power from Bradley goes to Fairbanks. So it is definitely a rail belt issue. As far as the plant itself, it does have two 60 megawatt generators. There was, when Bradley was constructed, a third pit. So we could put in a third generator if we needed to. But even with this upgrade, we believe the two generators will be fine. We'll just be running the plant more efficiently, have more water, be able to run it more stable across the 12 months of the year.
Senator Stedman, follow-up?
Yes, just on the third generator. Later on through this process, it would be nice to understand why you wouldn't put in a third generator so you could have one as a spare for maintenance. And so you always have two available to spin at all times.
There.
Yeah, through the chair. Primarily, that's a cost issue. The one thing with Bradley, and I'm not an engineer, but one of the issues with Bradley is Bradley was designed to have three 40-megawatt power generators, and they put in two 60-megawatts, hence the reason with oscillation issues sometimes, the harmonics, is because the pit it was designed to be put in was too big with the 60-megawatt. Maybe they had a sale 32 years ago on generators. So that's one of the issues, but the third pit is there, and so putting in a third generator, maybe not at 60, but maybe at a 40-megawatt, is possible. The dam was designed to do that. If you go outside of the dam, you'll see where it's all connected to do that. The transformers are all there. It's just that the third generator was not put in. But that is a cost issue, but we can pull it. We can get that information for you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I'm trying to get the lay of the land myself, you talked about if this system were FERC regulated, two lines would be a minimum. RCA regulations in some parts of the state require on-site backup generation when you've got your primary generation remote. Do the utilities that use Bradley Lake Power have to have on-site backup generation?
Through the chair, they do. You have spinning reserve. That's one of the advantages is with a BESS system. Our battery storage system is they would not need to have the spinning reserve because they would have a battery that's available. And so if there was a problem on the system, they could bring up natural gas generation, but they can operate off the battery for a period of time. So that's one of the advantages of having a battery systems or a BESS in each one of the locations in the system.
Follow-up, Senator Keel.
Thank you.
One of the questions I do have is that, as you talked about, 17% of the power that comes out of Bradley Lake goes on up to Fairbanks. What are they paying for that as compared to what they're paying there coming out of Bradley Lake?
Mr. Chair, I would have to confirm that number because there are wheeling rates, which is part of 207, is to try to eliminate wheeling rates and be more universal. So I would have to get you that exact number. But I do know there's a gentleman behind me, or three of them, that probably, if they're still there, who probably have that number off the top of their head.
Okay. Senator Stemmer, you got a follow-up? Okay, any further questions by members of the committee for Mr. Thayer? Go ahead and go on to the next slide, please.
The one where we talk about the GRIP or the grid resilience, the HVDC line, this obviously is coming from Nikiski across the inlet. One of the biggest, this is our project. We have 8 years to complete this project by statute. An act of Congress would take it to extend it. But this is where we're taking the HVDC line, which is a high-voltage direct current line from Kenai, Nikiski, all the way to Bradley Lake. It's about 39 miles across Cook Inlet. There's some converter stations on both sides. And with that, this improves the resilience and reliability for these communities and gives us that second line off the Kenai Peninsula. This is also going to create, you know, $413 million is going to create thousands of jobs during the construction of this, and especially in the indirect. Some of the challenges that we have with this, and we'll know more after this season's field season, is the availability of the HVDC line itself, where there might be three or four projects a few years ago in the world. There's more than a dozen HVDC projects in the world, and we are one of the smaller ones in the sense of capacity. And so a question we need to look at is do we need special, have our line specially built, or is it something more off the shelf will help us with cost? And so we'll be running a lot. We'll be ordering this after or during the NEPA process. So we'll be simultaneously. And then it'll probably be 2 years for the actual construction, 2 to 3 years of installing the line. And with that, the HVDC subsea cable, here's a picture of one. It's about 8 inches in diameter. It would roughly carry 250 megawatts is the transfer capacity, and would be putting two across the inlet. And it would be the cable depth will be buried in the seabed 4 to 6 feet. We also understand that the bottom always changes, and we got boulders the size of cars. There's a lot of pipelines down in Cook Inlet, so it's not that it hasn't been done before. But one of the challenges we have is it hasn't been done for many years. And so we'll be looking at, and that's one of the things that we're spending time with this summer is looking at, again, exactly the routing of that. One of the challenges we have in Cook Inlet is there's a trench in the middle of Cook Inlet, so you kind of have to go up and across. And so those are some of the challenges. But there are people that have been there and done this before us, and so they're the ones helping us today.
Are there very many other transmission lanes that go across Cook Inlet that are already in place?
Through the Mr. Chair, Chugach Electric has a couple, not HVDC, but they do. And then majority of them are natural gas and oil pipelines.
And how do they go ahead and protect themselves against anchor seismic activity, earthquakes and the like?
Mr. Chair, I'd have to get back to you exactly how, because everyone is a little bit different. I know from my days at NSTAR, NSTAR lines are actually encased in concrete and held to the bottom floor that way, and then they're dug in, directionally drilled up into the shore banks, and so they don't move. They're regularly pigged to make sure that they aren't moving, and also to make sure that they are clear of any obstruction. As far as my days with NSTAR Natural Gas,
that's good. Thanks.
On this particular slide is just the schedule as far as we hope to have the award in the second quarter of 2024. And again, this summer, start preliminary engineering, complete the design, and then by 27, complete the NEPA process, and then our contractor selection in 2028 to 29 is the long lead items, and then the construction from January 2030 to 31. This is an example of a type of ship that lays the cabling. From the stern, and they do a jet plow in barrowing it across. And again, these ships, the availability of these ships is the cabling are one of our challenges, and that's one of our key components that we are trying to better understand in the next year is the availability of all these parts to come together during a construction season.
Senator Hoffman has a question.
Just a question. You may not know the answer to this, but how similar is laying this cable as compared to laying cable for broadband that is being contemplated throughout Western Alaska?
Mr. Chair, I do not have the answer to that. I know one of the challenges that we have with the HVDC line is to make sure that it has a shield on it, enough that it can handle the bottom and the boulders and anything that might happen to it, which is very different than the broadband. Plus, it's a lot larger, 8 inches, and very heavy. But I can try to get you an answer for that, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You would go ahead and continue.
And, next slide is the GRIP 3 Round 2. This is the Blue Bit of Healy. Again, this is in the application phase only. We did apply on April 17th. And what we would do is, if we were to receive funding, is look at initial design and permitting, engineering and NEPA process. Again, this is above line. This would be adjacent or near the natural gas pipeline. So routing has already been identified, and then the construction will be a little longer in 4 years. They have estimated cost of $730 million. And actually, this picture is actually when they were doing the intertie from Willow to Healy, the helicopter there with one of those towers. But again, this is in the interview, or this is just in the application phase. The next item I highlighted, and that was on the Kenai Peninsula, the Sterling to Quartz Creek, the SSQ line, 39 miles. Again, it's along the highway. If you drive that route, you would have saw us removing poles the last couple of years, the old 69 KV. It is AA-owned, and the upgrade is $90 million, and this work is doing right now. So if you were on the Kenai Peninsula right now, and you looked at Bradley at $342 million to do Dixon Diversion, then you looked at $413 million to do the HVDC, plus this $90 million. There's going to be a lot of construction activity in South Central Alaska just on these three projects. We've never seen anything like it. Just the Dixon Diversion alone would be the third largest hydro project in the state if we were to do that. And then we'd be doing this simultaneously, or this project as well as the HVDC. We've talked a little bit about the battery energy storage system.
Sorry. Hey, we have a couple questions. Mm-hmm. Senator Stedman.
Yes, back on 13. Let's, as we speed along and we put the foundation down, I think at some point, and maybe it's when we have the bills in front of us, we need to talk about the ownership, why the state of Alaska would own the intertie system, not the local utilities or some other consortium. I don't think the state owns the intertie system in Southeast. It just seems to be a step that's automatically taken, but I think we need to review that.
There, you got to have that conversation.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman. I understand. I know we've had this conversation, a similar conversation before. One of the things that SB 217 does in its latest reincarnation of the bill, and that is put all the transmission assets into an RTO or a rail belt transmission organization, where it would not only be AEA but also the utilities that would govern in these and help manage these assets. As far as the ownership of them, I think that's a conversation that probably is a conversation that needs to be had at a different time than right now on them, because right now with them being federal grants, then they become state assets. But that's not saying that something doesn't happen down the road with those assets.
Would AEA be in favor of that?
I work for a board of directors, and we have not had that discussion, so I would not want to get in front of my board.
Okay. Follow-up, Senator Stedman?
Yeah, just on that. No, I kind of understand that as far as we get up one morning and there's large jets coming out of Washington to do some of these energy projects, and we want to seize the moment because we have problems with our grid in the rail belt. I think we all recognize the challenges are, but it'd be nice to know that when we accept these grants, you know, how long would we have to hold them in the state entity before we divest them to the local utility or another entity that we create to manage the grid? Because when I look at the grids in the Southern 48, there are multiple states wide, not just a little area in one state. So it looks to me like we're kind of an anomaly here with all these little pockets, or I think it's commonly referred to as islands or however you want to call it. And if we're not inadvertently ending up with more costs than we should in the end by some consolidation.
Senator Bishop has a question.
The award date on GRIP 3, tentative?
Through the chair, is tentatively for August, September.
Thank you.
Of 2024.
2024, yes, sorry.
Senator Stedman.
Maybe I wasn't clear enough on my question, Mr. Chairman. Is there commitments within these grants, GRIP 1 and 2, that disallows divestiture over a period of time, or are we free once we take the federal money and build these projects to change ownership out of the state, if we so choose?
Through the chair, I would have to I'd have to research that.
Well, Senator Stedman, go ahead and continue.
when we talk about the battery energy storage system, this is actually a picture of the battery system in Homer. The tower in front is not part of the BESS, but you're looking down is the BESS system, which is basically Conax trailers. I say Conax, that's not exactly what they are, but that's what they look like. And they are like similar to servers with power units in them across the line. Again, this is a two-hour battery, 47 megawatts. When it was built, it was the largest on the West Coast. It has now been surpassed by one, I think, in Arizona with this. When we looked at it, the cost to have batteries in all three locations is, we believe, approximately $168 million. That cost is always going up. And we have $58 million currently available. When I say currently available, when we had the $166 million funding for required project work on Bradley, $90 million was set aside for the SSQ line upgrade. $20 million was for routing and for the grip, which we recently did through bondholder approval. And then $58 million was set aside to look at the batteries, look at battery options between Kenai, or Southern and Central and Northern being Fairbanks. And this, of course, depends on technology, capacity needs, and prices are continuing to grow. To grow. As far as this, I think right now I'm on HB 307, which and 217, and I think that's been morphed, and you are looking at a new bill tomorrow. So I don't know if this is a point where we want to stop. I do want to mention, just for the record, there's other projects within AEA. We were recently awarded Solar for All competition, which was $62 million from EPA. And this allows low-income disadvantaged households that would benefit from rooftop solar, which is going to be administered by Alaska Housing. And then community solar projects, which will be done by the Alaska Energy Authority. And there is no match requirement by the state for this grant. And we've just got word on this grant, and so we'll be putting together the criteria, but we're going to it's going to be very similar to the REF program. It's a successful program as far as the application, the review process, the economics, the technology, the location, the cost of energy for those communities. But I see primarily the community, these community ones will be in rural Alaska. And we have been working with DOT looking at airport land as a possibility of where to put some of these solar farms. And then I did bring up during the conversation, we did apply for $342 million for the Dixon Diversion through a climate pollution reduction grant. In addition to that, we've also, for rural energy programs, we applied for $50 million. We've partnered with Tanana Chiefs Conference in the Northwest Arctic Borough, and the proposal includes funding for diesel engine replacements, rural distribution system upgrades, and energy efficiency upgrades for public infrastructure. This is a competitive grant. There is no match required, and the selection is supposed to be in July of 2024. We also continue to do our work with the Department of Transportation, with the NEVI, or the State of Alaska Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program. There's a corridor. There will be seeing charging stations go into the corridor between Anchorage and Fairbanks, the alternative fuel corridor, and then we'll be looking at Anchorage to Homer and then along coastal communities, because the ferry system is part of the national highway system. And so Ketchikan, Sitka, Juneau, any communities that's served by a ferry will also be eligible for these charging stations. And we currently have roughly $20 million or $30 million already available for those charging stations. In addition, AEA last year received, the legislature gave us also the Federal Receipt Authority, we received $37 million for home efficiency rebates and another $37 million for home electrification and appliance rebates, for a total of $74 million. There was no state match required. We are partnering with Alaska Housing on this one. They have similar programs, and so rather than create our own program, we're partnering with Alaska Housing so we can administer and get more money out on the street for that particular funding. We've talked about Black Rapids, $5.7 million, or $15.7 million for that grant. When we partner with Golden Valley, And then there's additional funding we have for state-based home energy efficiency contractor training for contractors into rural Alaska and urban state energy program, and then energy efficiency revolving loan fund that we're going to be working with Alaska Housing on. So when you look and you tally everything up, we currently have about $750 million that we've recently received, and we have requests out, or we have pending applications for over $1 billion. And so when you look at AEA, when I started 5 years ago, our budget was $21 million. And when you look at everything that we currently have, not applied for, but funding in hand, or we're in negotiations with and with the bonding, our budget has actually grown by 2,600%. And the people on here is the team at AEA. So when we talk about all this funding, we've added about a half a dozen new people, and we'll be adding more, obviously, as these projects go into fruition. But that's the team at AEA.
That's certainly impressive. 2,600% is a fair amount of pesos.
Yes, yeah, Mr. Chair, it is.
I understand.
I think we should put him in charge of the Marine Highway.
Any further questions, my members of the committee, for Mr. Stayer? Don, thank you very much for coming up this afternoon.
Thank you.
Next we have up is Gwen Holdman with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, University of Alaska Fairbanks. She's certainly an expert in energy, having worked on many other renewable projects. We are tentatively scheduled for 3 o'clock, but we can go a little bit over if your presentation is going to be longer than that. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you very much. My name is Gwen Holdman with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak here before the committee today. I'd love to kind of take this up to a little bit of a higher level and talk a little bit about why some of these transmission reforms are important, necessary, and timely in the context of what's been happening in other energy markets and where we are today in terms of the opportunities and the challenges that are before us. So I think like our vision for the rail belt, and I prefer the map that that Director Thayer showed earlier, but you know, there's really a vision that we have for our rail belt future, which includes getting low-cost energy to end users wherever it's produced and wherever they're located. You know, I'm certainly not going to argue with members of the committee that talk about the challenges of high-cost energy in rural Alaska. I was just in Nome last week, and the cost for heating oil there is $7.50 a gallon. But the costs are rising on the rail belt for many different reasons. And right now, with the latest rate increase for Golden Valley Electric Association, I am paying nearly 30 cents a kilowatt hour for electricity, about 29 something and change. And in comparison, the rates in Bethel reported through the Power Cost Equalization Program once PCE has been applied is 26 cents a kilowatt hour. So just kind of put that in perspective, rates are going up. As rates are going up on a rail belt, that means that the floor for the calculation for the PCE program is coming up, and we're distributing less resources to rural Alaska because of that. So it's in all of our interests, as Senator Hoffman noted, that we can work to lower costs on the rail belt. And I think that the legislation that you'll be reviewing over this next few days are really instrumental in making sure that we can set a stage for that to happen. So we want the cheapest power to consumers wherever it's located and wherever they are located relative to those potential projects. We'd like to see more projects at scale. This committee is well aware that if you build a larger project, that you're going to have more economies of scale associated with that. We'd rather have fewer large projects and distribute those benefits to users across the system. And we want to make sure that we can retain system reliability and potentially improve it. And that's a big part of what these GRIP projects, these new transmission projects that we're talking about do, is that they maintain and improve reliability even in the face of adding more variable resources to our grid. So whether we call this restructuring or deregulating, this is something that has happened all over the world in terms of modernizing the way that we produce and manage our electric systems. Historically, utilities have been structured as really natural monopolies, and as such, they're regulated. And this is really because they're extremely expensive. A lot of the assets that are associated with our electric power infrastructure are extremely expensive. They have very long lives, and we don't really need to see competition in certain aspects of that market. And a big one is around transmission. That's a great example. You just heard a lot about the very high costs and long periods of time to both build out these assets, but then how long they can serve customers. And so most of the time it's considered this is an opportunity for a natural monopoly. You don't want to have 20 sets of transmission lines. You want to have one. At the same time, we have seen a lot of new innovation when it comes to generation assets, including the renewable energy resources. And so this is actually an area where in most markets competition is welcomed and actually benefits consumers. So again, what you want to see is you'd like to see competition in the parts of the market where ratepayers are actually benefited by that competition, and you want to maintain monopolies over the portions where ratepayers would pay a higher cost if there was multiple competing interests in that particular sector. So one thing just to be clear, and I don't want to spend too much time, and please obviously feel free to ask questions as we go along here, but market restructuring, when we do those sorts of things, it almost always requires some sort of legislative action. I have the acronym here, FERC. That's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. That's at the federal level. Alaska is exempt from those regulations because a lot of those are established due to interstate commerce, and so basically where transmission lines cross state borders, and that's not the case for Alaska. And so we've really had an opportunity here both to be a bit exempt from a lot of the changes that have been made at the national level, and at the same time that gives us a chance to really chart our own path, take advantage of best practices, not just from the U.S. but from other places nationally. Deregulation isn't always, in the end, has not always benefited the consumers. I just pulled a few random, just quick kind of snapshots from news articles about cases where there's been at least perceived negative impact to consumers related to deregulation. Again, this gives us an opportunity. This is something that's been going on all over the world for decades now. We have a chance to learn lessons from what's worked, what hasn't, where there's been hiccups, where there's opportunities for improvement. We've seen a lot of those things, and we have a chance to really get our house in order in ways that draws from best practices from other markets. Here's just some of the realities of our rail belt today. We do need to upgrade our transmission system. I have heard very few arguments against this. Our transmission system compared to those in the rest of the country has very little redundancy. It's a very vulnerable system, and there's no doubt that there's a need to upgrade and modernize that transmission system. One thing that's unique about Alaska as a whole, but the rail belt grid specifically, is that we are dominated by public power, and I think that this is an important point to make. A lot of times when we look at markets where they're deregulating things, a lot of it's really based on the fact that you have investor-owned utilities. So you have utilities that have a profit motive. Our utilities are primarily public power in the state of Alaska. And in the case of the rail belt, they're cooperative utilities, they're member-owned utilities. Therefore, any profits or any savings that they realize really flows back to the end consumer. And that's actually an important part to realize because it's pretty unusual in the U.S., in particular, Nebraska, I think, is the only other state in the country that is entirely dominated by public power utilities. We have a lot of utilities on the rail belt. We still have five at this point in time. And rail belt politics are inherently local. I think this is a pretty important point. These utilities grew up around individual communities or service territories, were interconnected over time by a transmission grid, and yet they are managed by boards that are elected by local members and such the politics associated with those utilities and the decisions that they're making are inherently based around local politics and the best interests of local consumers, not necessarily the system as a whole.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Holdman, I guess to that last point, if you could spend a minute on its interaction with your earlier point in this slide about the notion that cooperative power associations, all the savings go back to the consumer. All the savings don't always go back to the same consumers, potentially from whom they were generated, right? If I can extract a cost from your area and realize it in my area, my consumers are doing better than yours, aren't they?
Ms. Holdman.
Senator Keel, through the chair, are you suggesting that within an individual service territory for an individual utility, are you talking about wheeling between different service territories?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not an expert with technical terms. I'm not going to say it's wheeling versus something else. But my observation is that while you may have throughout the rail belt cooperative power associations, they don't cooperate with one another so good.
Senator Keel, through the chair, that is absolutely true. At various times, there have been all kinds of different disagreements among the utilities. Again, largely this being due to the fact that these are locally represented entities that are elected by local members, local member owners. The board is locally elected. The utility is managed by folks that are appointed. The CEO is appointed by that board. And as such, there have been a lot of disputes over time. And some of those disputes are exactly the reason why having some kind of a overarching transmission organization is an important way to kind of address those sorts of disputes. On the other hand, there are examples of where they have been able to manage those disputes effectively themselves. Director there talked about the Bradley Project, which is overseen by the Bradley Project Management Committee. That has a effective and well-tested dispute management resolution process that's worked over several years. So there are examples of where they've managed these disputes well, but they certainly do not have a monolithic approach to any of these challenges.
Honorable Senator Keel, not go ahead with your presentation.
Okay, thank you. So I mentioned that we have largely avoided deregulation that's been forced upon us from outside of the state. And that also brings up this last point, which that sometimes finding good corollaries to Alaska can be really challenging. We all know how unique Alaska is in many ways, and this is a very good example. Our energy market is not like any others in the United States, which is why at times our center, the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, has looked at models that are both outside of Alaska as well as Hawaii, which is the closest corollary to Alaska, and also Texas, which actually operates as an isolated grid by choice as well. And so it also has its own set of regulations that it follows. When we look at constraints on our grid, there's really three different types of constraints that we're talking about. Some of those are technical constraints, and that's really where these new assets that we are looking at constructing, whether they're energy storage or they're additional transmission lines, help alleviate some of those technical constraints and bottlenecks. We also have some economic constraints that we've alluded to, and some of those include our limited future gas reserves, the need for economic dispatch. Economic dispatch is really a term where you want to use the cheapest power that can be generated on the system first or next. And then secondly, we're really looking at that question around economies of scale. We'd rather build bigger wind projects where the resource is best rather than a number of smaller projects where the resource might be less adequate. It's better to build at scale. That saves everybody money in the long run. And then these institutional constraints is another important point that the legislation that you'll be reviewing is designed to address. And so in that particular case, we have a lot of different ownerships of this rail belt transmission grid. There's no organization right now, no entity that's looking out for the good of the system as a whole. It's being managed really as these individual assets, whether some of them are AEA owned, some of them are owned by the individual utilities, and no one's really looking at the system holistically. And so this legislation, SB 217, is designed, or the Senate, the committee substitute, is really designed to address that issue, so that we do have somebody looking out for the good of the system as a whole. These issues are not new. There's a lot of very experienced legislators in this committee, so I won't trouble you because you can probably remember more examples than I can. But we have been trying to deal with this idea of how we can make most advantage of the assets that we have through having a unified system that can benefit users across that system. One example that's from 2019 is the idea of having a for-profit transmission organization. So this would have been an organization that was established as an independent transmission operator, transmission corporation, that would have held those transmission assets and looked out for that system as a whole, including the investment into new assets. In that kind of case, you've got a for-profit entity that's sort of pancaking on top of our existing pretty high cost of generated power. And so one of the concerns that several of the utilities had is that we're really too small of a market to be able to afford that additional layer of like a for-profit organization onto there, because that would just represent an additional increase in costs associated with that particular service. So what all this kind of means is that we wind up being in a bit of a prisoner's dilemma when it comes to our transmission grid. That kind of means that we've got this paradox in decision-making where you've got these independent utilities that are operating in their own best interests at every moment. And those single best interests are not necessarily in the best interests of all of the users across the system. And if we were looking out for the interests of all of the users across the system, every individual utility and their own members would actually benefit more. But it's very difficult to get to that position because of these individual boards that are operating autonomously. And so that's one of the things that the legislation is intended to address.
Mayor Wilson.
Yeah, I just want to put on the record, I don't think that's true for all of those utilities. I think some are like that, but I've never been in a meeting with my utility, Manitoba Electric Association. I think they've done a really good job looking at the whole system and trying to find solutions. So I just want to be careful of commenting upon the negativity of our power utilities in the state.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, that's a point very well taken. And I don't in any way mean to disparage our utilities. I think they're doing an extremely good job every single day in trying to get us the least cost power and looking out for the best interests of our members. The current management at Matanuska Electric Association has very much been looking out for the big picture and has been absolutely a leader. They are the ones that were selected by the other rail belt utilities to represent their group as constituents on the governor's task force, and there was a really good reason why they were selected in that role. However, I would say that even the leaders of Matanuska Electric Association would agree that in the past, Matanuska Electric Association has not always been the benevolent entity that it is today. I think from my perspective, they've each taken a turn at being a little bit challenging to work and less willing to be collaborative with their partners across the system as a whole. And that's exactly the kind of thing that we want to move away from, is just having any one bad actor create challenge for every single utility in the system. So, but absolutely, Matanuska Electric Association has shown a lot of leadership in all of this.
Senator Bishop has a question.
I would just comment, if we could all get along, I got 65 years of studies on my desk in there, and we wouldn't even be having this conversation today.
Ms. Holman, continue, please.
Thank you. I think that in the past, the way that the utilities have found a way to work effectively together is often when there are opportunities. And right now is a very good example of that. We have an opportunity for really generational investment in these assets that is creating a space for these utilities to seek to work together. And I think that that really makes this an opportunity right now that we should seize and try to address some of these issues. The Alaska Center for Energy and Power has recently completed a pretty comprehensive study, really looking in part at if we are adding new generation to the system over time, how does that impact reliability? And where would those future assets potentially be located on the grid? This is just one of several studies, so I don't want to overemphasize the details of this. But what I do want to just point out is that there is going to be an increasing need to be using the transmission system. The location of where generation assets will be located in the future is going to be different than it is today. One example of that would be that there's a very good wind prospect up in the Golden Valley area, and there's a desire by other utilities, such as Matanuska Electric Association, to share in building a project at scale that they would all benefit from. So while historically we have typically moved power from south to north, in the future there's going to be more times where we're probably moving power from north to south as well. So the location changes and the amount that we're actually using that transmission system changes over time as well. So I really want to focus on two goals. The legislation has a number of provisions that, and I don't want to focus on those today. I don't believe that's the purpose of today's hearing, but I do want to focus on this question around eliminating these wheeling rates and this pancaking of wheeling rates and why that's important. And then secondly, why the development of an organization that can kind of oversee, manage, and develop the backbone transmission assets over time, and then is also subject to appropriate regulation is an important goal. First of all, when we look at these pancaking wheeling rates, I'm going to just actually skip this slide. I'm going to go to the next one just to save your time a little bit. But what that really means here is what we're right now, the way that our system works today is that I just mentioned this wind farm in the Golden Valley territory. So if that was to be built, and let's just say, and these are made up numbers, I just want to be clear about that. I have no knowledge of any contractual arrangements, but let's just say that wind farm offered to sell power into Golden Valley at 8 cents a kilowatt hour for energy that could be produced and put into the system. If you are a utility on the southern end of that intertie and you would like to participate in that particular project, you don't just pay that 8 cents, but you have to pay all of those cumulative costs of moving the power through these different asset owners' transmission system before it gets to you. And so by the time it gets to you, that might be 10 cent power. And at that point in time, it might be more advantageous to you to build a smaller local solar farm, let's say, or something like this. And so what we wind up seeing then is that it's a real disincentive to building projects at scale for independent power producers. And as much as I sort of talked about the benefits from the GRIP projects that we have right now with federal funding, that's also the case for developing these renewable energy projects or really low carbon energy projects. There's real generational opportunities for tax credits and other incentives for building those projects. And we want to see those projects constructed here on the rail belt and to the extent possible where independent power producers can attract private financing and develop those projects at scale. That's a good thing that we all benefit from. So what we really want to do is find a mechanism for instead of tying the cost for the transmission system to the energy that's put onto the grid, we want to find a different way to allocate those fixed costs directly to end users so that we're not making decisions about which generation to invest in or to put on the grid. We don't want to tie that to the cost of transmission because there's not actually an incremental cost for adding that additional kilowatt hour to the system. There's fixed costs associated more or less with operating this transmission system, and it's not really necessary to tie that cost to the source of generation because it confuses decisions about economic dispatch of those assets. And I'll just give an example I like to think about this as a little bit of like getting rid of the toll road. Another way that we can kind of look at that here, this is adapted from a slide that was presented by Chugach Electric Association in a House Finance Committee hearing last week. They're at Chugach right now. Their transmission costs are somewhere in a neighborhood of $30 million a year, and that's pretty fixed. If they have another utility that's moving power through their system right now, so let's say that there's power from Bradley Lake moving up to Golden Valley, they are taking that those costs, and let's say it's a dollar per unit. I'm making this up, okay? I'm just using easy numbers here. They're moving that power through the system, and they're charging consumers a dollar per some unit, okay? Their ratepayers would have otherwise paid that dollar per unit, but now they're offsetting their costs by the amount that's been paid by those consumers in Golden Valley's territory, okay? And so those Golden Valley consumers might be paying a dollar per unit, but they're taking that and they're reallocating back as a credit to their own customers. And so then at the end of the day, their ratepayers might pay 90 cents, right? Now, I want to just make the case that we are talking about very tiny fractions of really a penny in most cases here. These are small dollar amounts. And so we're not talking about some huge difference in terms of the amount one ratepayer in one service territory might pay or another. But what it does do is it makes a really big difference in the potential viability of some of these projects that we want to develop. And so what we want to do is we just want to allocate those costs for transmission directly to the end users without tying it to where the source of generation is. So it doesn't really change things for the ratepayers. You're going to pay for transmission one way or the other. But it changes the decisions about how we're dispatching and making investment decisions in individual projects. So it's something that I think most folks agree makes a lot of sense in terms of modernizing our system and the way that we're managing it.
I can understand how that is, but how do you make sure that it's fair or that the end user feels it's fair, especially if they're a co-op owned member?
So I think fairness is a really big part of this conversation, and I do believe that a lot of co-ops and by extension their members have felt that certain aspects of this system aren't fair. And that includes things like making decisions about how those assets are managed, when maintenance is done. You know, there's a lot of things that one utility might do that really impacts users in another part of the system. And those are the kinds of things we're trying to get away from. In terms of fairness, the fairness in this case is that everyone should pay the same on a kilowatt hour basis. So if you're purchasing a kilowatt hour, here's the amount of money that the transmission costs as a component of that. And in a lot of markets, that's split out as a separate number. So you know how much the transmission costs are. And those should be the same for rate classes across the system as a whole. And in my mind, that seems fair.
So as you look at the whole concept of the postage stamp type of thing where you can mail a letter from here across town or here to Washington, D.C., do you ever envision a time where in the state of Alaska we'll have that same kind of system where we all pay the same rate for the electrical transmission, whether you live in St. Lawrence Island or you live in downtown Anchorage?
Senator, that is a conversation I would welcome having. It's something I think about a lot. There are other places that that do postage stamp rates. Mm-hmm. And we have at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power been looking at that very extensively. And it's something that we would welcome the opportunity to present on because there's a lot of very interesting and different models in different jurisdictions that would be worth having a longer conversation about.
As you look at rates, one of the things I was thinking about was what about international rates? If for some reason you got a bunch of hydropower that's down in Hyder or something like that, and they want to sell power over to the Canadian side, do we have that mechanism in place to allow this international type of transmission line?
Well, we do have at least one community in this state that's actually purchasing power from Canada. Senator Stedman, I forget the name of the community. It's certainly in Southeast, Hyder, yeah. And so there are complications potentially associated with that because when we look at the transmission system in Canada, it's part of the North American transmission system. And so connecting into that could have some interesting repercussions that I'm actually not certain of what those would actually be.
Okay. Go ahead and continue with the presentation.
So the second thing is really about this development of an organization that can kind of oversee and look out for the best interests of the transmission system as a whole. This is an example of where we have borrowed at least some inspiration from what has happened in Iceland. Iceland has had 3 decades of deregulating their grid. They were forced to do so by European Union regulation. They kind of went into that kicking and screaming. They evolved that system over 3 decades. They started out with kind of a for-profit Transco transmission corporation model. They felt their grid and their population was too small to have that additional layer of cost added onto their bills. And so they have over time kind of moved toward a model that's somewhat analogous to the concept, in concept at least, the Rail Belt Transmission Organization that's been proposed here. The other part of the inspiration for it is really this Bradley Project Management Committee. It's something that that I at least have spent quite a bit of time familiarizing myself with. It's a pretty transparent management structure. You can go to the website on the Alaska Energy Authority site, and you can find all the meeting minutes, the recordings from those meetings. And this is a system that has really worked. And this is one thing that all of the Rail Belt utilities that I speak to today agree on, is that this structure has worked in terms of conflict resolution over time. And there's been significant conflict. There's been lawsuits, and they have managed those conflicts, and it has worked. And I think that when we have a system that's worked without a significant amount of additional cost and complexity, it's something that we can mirror or borrow from in terms of a system that we want to expedite in terms of the process of moving forward with these things. So why now? Why is this important at this moment? I think that there is really some urgency of the moment with this. There is these federal funding opportunities, both with the GRIP assets, but also with private sector investment through independent power producers and developing out renewable assets. And then secondly, just addressing the high and increasing cost of power for consumers, we want to do whatever we can to set up a market that allows us to get the lowest cost power to consumers that we possibly can. And these changes to the transmission system would set us up for having that lower cost power made available to our consumers across the system. So that's all I have.
Any other questions? Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Olson. I think it's interesting that the Rail Belt members of this committee are the minority, and the three of us represent only 2 of the electric utilities. So my question for Ms. Holdman would be, what advice do you have for us to balance our responsibility to our individual constituents with the looking at the state as a whole?
Ms. Holdman.
Thank you, Senator Merrick, through the chair. I've noticed that, it's interesting. But you know, as I think Senator Hoffman said earlier, we are one state, and we are in this together. And ultimately, the quickest and most expeditious way to get less expensive power in rural Alaska is to see those costs come down on the Rail Belt. Right now, the way that we are addressing the high cost of power in rural Alaska is through the Power Cost Equalization Program, and that's based on largely, not entirely, Juno is certainly part of the equation, but largely based on the cost of power on the Rail Belt. That cost is coming up. That's a threat to the cost of power in rural Alaska as well. Do I believe that there should be additional things that we could do to address the extremely high cost of energy in rural Alaska? Absolutely. Today, we're looking at this particular issue around the Rail Belt, and I feel like that's one very important part of the equation, because the largest part of the population of Alaska does live on the Rail Belt, and we have tied we've connected our system together in a way that economically it would benefit all of us to try to make sure that we have a affordable energy for Alaskans wherever they're located.
So you're optimistic about the whole situation. Is that true?
What did you say?
You're optimistic about the whole ability to go ahead and afford electricity.
We have to put one foot in front of the other every single day, and I'm sure that all of you are very much in that boat. And so in my mind, I've been working on these energy issues across the state for many, many years, as you all know, and I think that this is actually an extremely important and potentially transformative piece of legislation because it allows a lot of other things to happen in the private sector, and that's what I'm excited about.
Follow-up, Senator Merrick?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Not any further questions by members of the committee for Ms. Holman? Matt, I want to thank you very much for coming out this afternoon.
Thank you.
We do have somebody in the audience that has been looking at this power electrification situation, and that's Angela Rodell. You care to come on up and just make a few comments on what the presentation we've looked at today, to look at it from your perspective as a person who's been involved with energy for a long time? Just identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Angela Rodell, staff to Senator Kathy Geisel. I would just provide a couple of comments, and I know that you'll be spending quite a bit of time on this issue over the next coming days and weeks that we have left. One of the things I would highlight is that this bill reflects a tremendous amount of work on the part of stakeholders throughout the state of Alaska, whether it be the utilities, whether it be independent power producers, regular Alaskans that are affected by this. And most legislation, as you all know, but way better than I do, you're always going to have pieces that don't make everybody happy. But at the end of the day, the compromise is really important. And as you've heard from the presenters before me say how important this is and how transformative this is. And if we can fix the transmission issues within the rail belt, within that part of Alaska, we benefit all of Alaska, either through economic growth, through lowering the cost and providing economic opportunity throughout Alaska. And so with that, I look forward to working with you on this in the coming days.
Great. Okay. This concludes this afternoon's meeting. Our next meeting will be tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And we'll be going over the rail belt transmission situation, which will continue on. We'll be hearing from Joel Groves, the chair of the Rail Belt Reliability Council, created by SB 123 in 2020. Then we'll take up House Bill 219, which is the repeal assistive technology loan program. And with that, we'll conclude the meeting.